Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Ian Hunter, someone who came out of cultural studies originally, worked at Griffith University in Brisbane, did a few visiting gigs in the States at Hopkins, Berkeley, places like this, and then wound up at the University of Queensland from where I retired about 10 years ago, and now in Brisbane trying to keep busy, intellectually speaking.
beavering away. Now, the background I can see behind you, Ian, is that a safe or a microwave or neither? The black object.
No, that's a cushion.
No, above the cushion. Above the cushion.
Oh, sorry, that's a window.
A window.
Yeah, there's a set of windows, yeah, and you could see a blind half drawn.
Oh, how
Yeah,
interesting.
yeah,
Okay.
yeah,
So, onto
yeah.
less pressing matters. I wanted to ask you what
Yes.
currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Okay, good. Yeah, look, I guess, I've been interested in something, I suppose, for a long time. And you could say, you could approach it by saying, well, it's about partly about the relationship between philosophical disciplines and historical disciplines. And I suppose originally, why is it often the case that these things don't play nicely together? These disciplines don't play nicely together. How did that come about? The thing I guess that's focused my mind on this the last 5, 6 years, apart from my own ongoing work on it, is some interesting new work by younger scholars, curiously, almost paradoxically, going back to the history of scholarship and the history of erudition. The guy at who was at Cambridge and now at Oxford, Dimitri Levitin, is perhaps the most well-known and famous of these people. But in Germany, there's a scholar called Martin Mulso, who works on the history of clandestine philosophy and clandestine philosophical movements. He has colleagues. Levitin has colleagues. I suppose you could put older scholars like Noel Malcolm. But this work on the history of scholarship, or the history of erudition, as they call it, has become paradoxically and completely implausibly incredibly militant. So these people have now adopted, particularly Dimitri Levitin, a very militant view about redoing the intellectual history so that the history of scholarship steps to the fore and the history of philosophy is pushed into the background, not to say hidden on the head with a wooden mallet and told that it doesn't belong here. So a history of philosophy done in the classic style of post-Kantian German idealism will tell you that there were unresolved contradictions between rationalism and empiricism, eudaimonism and deontology and so forth. And then Kant suddenly stepped onto the stage in Königsberg, had a bright idea and reconciled the oppositions. And that's how we got into modern philosophy. Now, what the history of scholarship people say, apart from, well, that's just rubbish, is, well, actually, an enormous amount of work was done between the Renaissance and the end of the 17th century on the history of philosophy. A lot of it's been lost sight of, and a lot of it is completely germane to the mainstream events of the day, particularly the question of how do you deal with religious conflict and theological conflict when philosophy and theology tends to be absolutist in its conception of truth, and you get this other style of thinking. Who's, if you like, its central strategy is to say, well, thinking itself is an activity that occurs historically. It occurs using certain arts and forms of thinking or devices of thinking, and it occurs for certain purposes. And typically, it's associated with a way of life, a culture, a people, a time. And if you see that, you're less inclined to say there's only one true philosophy. because you then say, well, look, there are lots of philosophies. They've all got a similar form, or they are all related to ways of life in a certain kind of way. And it can lead to a kind of, I don't say relativism, but a relativistic view of the history of philosophy. And it reminds me, I'm always reminded of a great remark that Richard Rorty made in this vein, where he said, we haven't worked out how to apply the concept of toleration to philosophy. And he was making, I think, exactly the right comparison. It took a few hundred years for Europeans to work out how to apply the concept of toleration to religion, and they didn't do it easily or voluntarily. They generally did it to end wars and stop pogroms and things like that. But Rorty's comment, I've always enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the provocation of it. I've enjoyed the point of it, that philosophy in general is an extremely intolerant field in which typically, because of the role of evidence being bound up with interpretation and hermeneutics, you never get a good batch of evidence that settles the question. I mean, it's not that historians are paragons in this regard, because they can dig in as well and dispute the evidence. But typically, there is evidence to be disputed over, and that's perhaps a problem. So, look, that was a long way around saying I've been interested for a long time in how this split occurred, if you like, in the Western European academy, between these major forms of thinking and ways of life. And German idealism, if you like, is for me the paradigm case leading into a modern style of philosophy of this type. But the thing, as I say, that I found interesting is the just curious resurgence of this otherwise antiquarian sort of work in the history of erudition, in the history of scholarship, that's become extraordinarily militant. So yeah, that's what's interesting me at the moment. Yeah.
Now, where does this militance take aim, or at what?
It frequently takes aim at philosophical historians, and hermeneutic historians, who, if you like, have a model of history in which history is either in the Kantian or in the Hegelian form, understood as proceeding dialectically through oppositions to arrive at the moment where consciousness recovers its own conditions, historical conditions, and in a sense brings an end to history. That style of history, which is obviously, I'm being very broad brush about it, but is very widespread. It's not just at work in the history of philosophy, it's at work in the history of politics, it's work in the in history of society and so forth. For example, John Rawls, Jürgen Habermas, working in social theory, and so I suppose philosophical social theory would be examples, leading exponents of this way of doing history. That's a typical target for these historians of erudition. I mean, you could say, look, here's a, this is a little bit of a caricature, but if you read a mainstream Kantian philosopher today, for example, Paul Guyer or Alan Wood, at some point near the beginning of their book, they will say, Kant found new principles of knowledge and morality through reflection on his own mind and found the structure of the mind. And then they might disagree about what it is, but nonetheless, that's the broad parameter within which they work. Whereas people coming from the history of erudition, history of scholarship, will say, no, nobody finds anything in their own minds that hasn't been put there by books. Okay? So what we want to know is, what books did these people read? And we even want to know what books did Kant read. Then we'll be able to talk about the forms of philosophy that were undertaken and their relation to other forms of philosophy and so on. So, yeah, I would say, you can see I am energized by this, and that, if you like, contrast or clash or difference between somebody saying knowledge comes from reading books and somebody who says it comes from in introspective self-reflection. That is a crucial dividing point.
So it sounds like they might have been reading Ian Hunter and Roger Chartier, these dudes.
No. Very few of them have read Ian Hunter. Many of them will have read Chartier, I'm sure. But no, they would have read people like J.G.O. Pocock. They would have read, some of them would have read the wonderful, wonderful works of Peter Brown, from originally Berkeley, perhaps still at Berkeley, for all I know. But if you read, I mean, in different ways, or in Pocock's Italian collaborator, Momigliano, these are old, I mean, old, but they are long standing scholars in the field who work in this way, and sometimes reflect methodologically on the fact of that they do work in this way. So Pocock pioneered the history of historiography as an alternative to philosophical history, if you like. Brown's extraordinary works on ecclesiastical history, on the late Roman and early Christian period, yeah, the late antiquity, which in a sense he pioneered. For me, late in my career, they became inspirational. I suppose I got to them in part, particularly Brown, through Foucault, and the late Foucault on ethics was another point at which I, for me, a sort of light came on. In fact, came on just as I was finishing my doctorate in 1986, which was when the second and third volumes of The History of Sexuality were translated into English. And when I read those, I thought, now I understood what literary criticism is. And that helped me consolidate the work in the doctorate. So I suppose that was a pathway, because then I realized that Foucault had worked with Peter Brown at Berkeley, that they'd shared a lot of interests in these areas, and I'd already read a lot of Pocock for other reasons, I suppose. And then in the little stint I had at Berkeley for a semester, sorry, at Hopkins for a semester in 95, Pocock was there. And I wouldn't say that I saw a lot of him or that I said a lot to him when I did see him. But he was also an inspiring figure. He was giving seminars in 95 on what he called multiple enlightenments. Now that would feed into his five volume Gibbon series. But as you know, I wrote a book called Rival Enlightenments in published in 2001, and it's not that I wasn't already on that track, but he confirmed, well, I'm someone who needs an authority to make me feel comfortable, I suppose. And the fact that he was working on that gave me a bit of a license to work on it. So,
As I recall, when that
yeah.
was in gestation, it was called dueling environments.
During dueling
Dueling
enlightenments,
environments.
I don't recall that, but then again, I don't vouch for my own memory at all now, so.
Sarah Berry and I caught the bus to Baltimore to visit you.
I recall.
We had a fun day, really fun day.
Yes. Yeah.
And
I was staying. Yeah.
Sarah was
Sorry,
just
go
here.
on.
She's bought a place in Girona,
Okay.
where
Oh,
she's
fantastic.
planning to
Yeah.
retire. It was lovely to
Remember her to me,
be
won't
here.
you?
I
Remember me
will.
to her. Yeah. 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 No, I was living in that old row house, as they call them. It was a three-story Gothic row house owned by Mary Poovey. And you and Sarah stayed, and we had a fun couple of days.
We did. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not what we're here to discuss, I realize, but I like these things to have occasional detours, as you may have.
Good, I'm pleased. Yeah.
And Pocock, yes, an enormously important figure. How does this relate to the dominant strand of philosophy in the Anglo world of the last 60 years? Logical positivism, analytic philosophy, we're like a science just as much as psychology wants to be a science. And we're not interested in any of this Kantian crap, or we've tried. Right? We want to be middle-aged Lutz, not young Lutz, and off we go.
It's a good question. I'm not sure that I've got a good answer for it. I would probably try and approach it by looking at Richard Rorty's defection from the analytic tradition and what that entailed. What an extraordinary act of defection, of departure that was, and his rejection of the metaphysics of objective knowledge, coming out of that tradition, or the idea that you could have knowledge through analytic, breaking down of concepts into their constituent parts, looking for a formal language in which concepts could be reconstructed so that they were utterly clear and lacking in all ambiguity, finding forms of validation based on reference. His overturning of that apple cart, if I can put it like that, or maybe the apple cart's still there and Richard's not, but that for me is a way into seeing what was happening. And then otherwise, I tend to have looked at analytic philosophy from the outside. I have done a little bit of work, weirdly, when I wrote a paper on Alain Badiou, it'd probably be, God, nearly 10 years ago, certainly 6 or 7, where I had to go back and do a kind of refresher course on set theory, and work out the relationship between set theory, formal maths, and formal logic. In order to get a sense of how the program worked at the level of people thinking they could provide absolute foundations for the structure of the world, quantification, and so on. So I have some acquaintance with that, but I don't consider myself expert in it. As I say, I look at it from another tradition. And you could say, well, so that's what Rorty did. He went back into the tradition of American pragmatism, and from there he found other resources to do philosophy. And I think, great. It's not particularly philosophy that I would do, but I think it's great. And then, of course, the other big story is paralleling analytic philosophy for since the early part of the last century was what's called continental philosophy. But which we could call post-Kantian idealism in the Heideggerian sort of stream of things, which has gone on and is sort of as big as ever, really, I think.
Here, I work at the Universidad Complutense de Madrid, which is sort of the top school in Spain, and it's been going for 600 or 700 years. The fascists bombed all the buildings during the Civil War, and there's no analytic philosophy taught,
Interesting.
none at all. But some people I've spoken to in the US and in Germany say that for them, the bifurcation is breaking down and there is greater tolerance slash interest on each side of that divide. And I think we would both acknowledge is problematic, but also sort of real. So it seems to be an interesting moment in some places, but not here.
Yes. Well, I mean, scanning the field here, I think that the ANU, the Australian National University, is still the premier analytic school. It's, they've got some people on the edges who aren't analytic philosophers, but basically, it's the center of analytic philosophy in Australia. I wonder though. Like, for example, at my immediate past university, the University of Queensland, philosophy, from when I arrived in the beginning of 2000, was already split, I think, reasonably amicably between continental and analytic. And the continental philosophers seemed to track along and do quite well. It's now a very, very small outfit. It shrunk to almost nothing. I don't know. I'd have to go and look people up. I suspect there are very few analytic philosophers left there, actually. There'll be a few continental philosophers. But given that continental philosophy can also play out in literature, cultural studies, and other departments, then it's got a different profile. And yeah, so yeah.
Different uptake. Yeah, I don't think Gilbert Ryle is being cited in literary studies the way that Jürgen Habermas is,
No.
other than by Alec, probably Alec if he wants to.
Oh, Alec. A lovely man.
So can I've got several other things I want to chat to you about, Ian.
Yes.
I'm going to have to turn off my camera and sound for a moment, not which won't
Yeah.
interrupt your answering the question, because the podcat is demanding a kind of attention that will be disruptive. But I'll be listening,
Right.
okay?
Okay.
So,
I will speak over the cat.
yeah, you speak over Chinguri. So,
Okay.
Prof, I wanted to take you back, as they say in baseball commentary, decades, but actually also to something you said only 20 minutes ago, which is that you came out of cultural studies. I think I'm quoting you. Could you
Yes.
tell us what that means and meant to you? What was cultural
Okay.
studies, and how does one ever escape it?
Yes. Well, I guess cultural studies for me at one point was a job locus. It was somewhere I could get work. When I first started at Griffith, I didn't have a PhD. I was on an 18-month contract as a junior tutor or lecturer. I was working in media, communications and cultural studies, which was a sort of a grab bag discipline at that stage, where we talked about film, media, those sorts of things, communications. So initially, as somebody who didn't plan to have an academic career, but who was looking to do some interesting work for a short period of time, it was a space in which I could get work. I suppose the other element to this was that when I was in a leaver site English department at La Trobe University in the late 60s, I suspect now for most listeners the name F.R. Leavis and the adjective leaver site would be almost unintelligible. But a style of criticism that was the leading exponent was a guy called F.R. Leavis, and it turned out he had disciples who ran a department of English at La Trobe University, where I was. One of the alternatives to Leavis was Raymond Williams. Raymond Williams was a pioneer of cultural studies, and he theorized the concept of culture and was taken to be producing a concept of culture that was more hospitable to non-elite, non-classical culture, that was more open to the thought of what are the social and sociological bases of culture, and was left-wing. And at that stage, you'll remember the a sort of colleague come fellow traveller of Williams was the historian E.P. Thompson, And The Making of the English Working Class by E.P. Thompson was also a big book for people that were getting into cultural studies and out of English, because it enabled you to think about the emergence of a class with its own culture, well, with its own future culture. That's the problem. I mean, in a way, E.P. Thompson was never happy with the actual culture of the working class, right? He was never happy with the fact that Methodists had taught a lot of working class people how to read and write, because they taught it to them in order to get them saved through Christianity. And E.P. Thompson wasn't happy with that. There was in the future to be an authentic working class culture, which would look like an Hegelian version of history that we discussed earlier, where the working class for the first time regained, sorry, gained true consciousness of its own determination by finding out what its material conditions were. I guess at one point I believed that for a short time. I wasn't totally persuaded, but all my mates were, all my friends were, they loved it. And I sort of, okay, it's good enough for them. E.P. Thompson turns out to be a far more interesting figure because he comes from an elite Methodist family, very wealthy elite Methodist family. So although he was attacking working class Methodist Sunday schools for not being revolutionary, he himself came from a very well-to-do, very moral, highly moral Methodist family. I felt I understood E.P. Thompson better when I learned that his elder brother, was with the Special Operations Executive, or anyway, one of those outfits, and was parachuted into Bulgaria, I think it was, to make contact with the anti-fascist resistance. Was betrayed by the anti-fascist resistance, I think, and killed as soon as he hit the ground. But his moral ethic, his belief in the rightness of what he was doing, made me think that it's helpful to understand someone like E.P. Thompson. It wasn't just that they were Marxists. They actually did believe that there was a moral order of society that would come. Later on, I guess that was what went by the board with this other style of history, one of whose premises, I guess, is that nothing's going to come, right? There's no destiny to history. There's actually a quote that I can't do properly, but it made a huge impact on me, from Foucault, where he says something like, yes, then we were interested in the laws that would make us what we had to be. Now we're interested in the contingencies that make us what we happen to be. I thought, yes, that's good. Now, that weirdly is exactly what Pocock says, that history is effectively unprogrammable. It's a chapter of accidents. It's unpredictable, and an historian mustn't try and lay down laws for how it will develop. But then, if you look at the ecclesiastical historians of the 17th century, which I'm sure everyone's bursting to do, you'll find people like Johann Mosheim, or people like Isaac de Bezobre, the great historian of Manichaeism. They had already taken this step because they said, look, the church is just an accident. The church is not the mystical body of Christ on earth. It's not the place where God reveals himself, was destined to reveal himself. It's just a human institution like every other institution, and its growth, its development, its changes are all unpredictable and random, and the historian's role is not to judge them, but to describe how they happen. And then you get these really fascinating histories where they redo ecclesiastical history so that things like the scandals, the power plays, the corruptions, all of that stuff is now front and center. So yeah, I that's a bit of a set of leaps, but You can see Foucault's anti-Hegelianism in that quote leads back to the kind of thing you'll find in Pocock, and that then leads back to these 17th century ecclesiastical historians and historians of the Bible, biblical critics, who occupy, I'm just looking up at my bookshelf, the bulk of volume 5 of Pocock's Barbarism and Religion. That's about those people, and he's absolutely spot on. Here's an anecdote. When he was writing that, because I'd met him, as I say, a couple of times at Hopkins, and I published Rival Enlightenments, he got was under the mistaken impression that I knew a lot about Germany and German cultural history. So he wrote me a letter. He never used email. He wrote me this. I still have it. Lengthy letter in tiny, tiny little hand. Could I send him my views on Johann Mosheim, Isaac de Beausobre, and several other people? I wrote him a very short answer back saying, look, I'm terribly embarrassed to tell you, I know almost nothing about these people, and I can't help you. But
I
if you
hope you.
like,
I
the
hope
silver.
you wrote a young man, comma. Thank you for your notes.
I should have. But then I got interested in those guys, and I went off, and of course I found they were, I could see exactly why he was interested in them. But these other guys, younger scholars that I mentioned, not just Dimitri Levitin, but the German guy Martin Mulso, and his colleagues Winfried Schroeder, and a tremendous younger scholar called Ralph Hefner. They've worked on all of this stuff and redone it to bring out precisely how unusual it was, how controversial it was, how much it fed into clandestine opposition to mainstream confessional historiography and so on. So that also I found really interesting. They worked on the Illumination societies, the secret societies that were carrying their own strands of enlightenment. So this then does go to people like Chartier and others who've worked on the same sort of stuff. So yeah, I think there's a lot for people that are doing, starting out in their research career and are looking to see, well, what's some really meaty and interesting stuff I could work on. There's a lot of untapped material in those areas. Yeah.
But presumably, what turned you away from cultural studies was what you saw as its notion of a transcendence that would come
Yes.
per
Yes.
your account of Thompson.
Yes.
I didn't know about his brother, by the way. And it's the relationship of this to the dialectic as a means of thought and as a future world. And it seems
Yes.
to me that that is a big part of your work because you're more a splitter than a lumper. You, it seems to me, like to look for exceptions to
Yes.
what are given as rules, be they implicit or explicit, and then work out how they can be understood taxonomically. That
Yes.
they may not be exceptions that stand on their own. They might be quite significant things that mean there are multiple stories and accounts that always need to be told. Does that seem like an unfair remark or reasonably accurate?
No, I'm very happy to live with that. I'm disposed when I find something, a writer, a problem, a topic, to I, my my I, do people know about Meccano sets now? I mean, you and I do, obviously, but constructor sets, I'm sure they're called in America. I have a kind of Meccano set mentality. I want to pull it apart to see how it works. Now, pulling it apart to see how it works, obviously that's a slightly fatuous way of looking at it, because you don't pull anything apart unless you've got tools and unless you've got a purpose for doing it. And that sort of historiography that I've mentioned is a set of tools, and it gives you a purpose. The purpose, I think you're right, is to say it detranscendentalizes it, because it thinks of thought as an activity carried out using arts and devices of various kinds. It treats all thinking as something that occurs in time, not as something that manifests itself in time from a transcendental position. Now, yes, you could say people like E.P. Thompson and Raymond Williams were also, in a sense, anti-transcendental at one level because they thought of themselves as materialists in a certain way. And cultural materialism was a phrase I recall coming out of Williams and into a sort of strand of thinking in cultural studies. The problem with materialism in a way is, can you use it without its ghostly partner of idealism lurking in the background? And hence, can you use it without a dialectic? As soon as you allow a dialectic, then materialism eventually gets absorbed into the task of forming consciousness. And forming consciousness then becomes, is it true consciousness? Has the working class finally found its own voice and so on? And then, yeah, I suppose that's where that's a lumping that I become a splitter with, because I say no. What we want to know is not is philosophy, is consciousness, is culture destined to have a development of that type, but what at any given point is called philosophy, and what constitutes it? What do people do when they say, "I do philosophy"? You know, you could say, and then you could have a quite good conversation about the history of philosophy in American universities. It's partly written by an interesting guy you've probably come across, Bruce Kircher, I think his name is.
No, I don't know.
So he's done some good books on the uptake of German idealism in American universities, about the scholars that went to Germany and studied under Kantians and Hegelians, and then came back to Harvard and Princeton and Yale, which were all seminaries of Protestant churches, and started to teach this philosophy in as a sort of new core for, if you like, an anti-Trinitarian or a Unitarian style of Christianity. John Rawls is just around the corner from that. He comes out of that, and that's a really interesting part of American cultural and academic history, I think. There's something about that that's on the edge of my mind. So in this massive and no doubt totally redundant book on Kant that I'm just finished, I came across I was thinking about American Kantianism. I was thinking about the Paul Guys, the Alan Woods, the Frederick Beisers, although he's more of an absolute idealist kind of guy, the Christine Korsgaards, the Rawls students, of whom Wood and Korsgaard are examples. And I was thinking about how when they do the history of philosophy, they do it in the Kant style. That there were these problems, people couldn't work out how to reconcile rationalism and empiricism. Kant came along, he stepped into history in order to reconcile those oppositions, and that's why we still teach them at Yale, Harvard, and Princeton today, right? That's their shtick. Now, if you look back at American Kantianism at the end of the 19th century, where it's still coming out of those seminaries and so forth, you find if you like, the beginnings of this style, but it's much more interesting because these are people who are Unitarians. They are reading Emerson and Thoreau. They are going on to communes where they all study Kant together. And then I came across this guy called Torrance, Torrence or Ance, William Torrance. Who was one of these American German idealists who was in he edited Fichte's Wissenschaftslehre, and he wrote a long preface to it. And in the preface, he records how he came across Kant and how Kant completely transformed him, because Kant taught him how to introspect on his own consciousness. And when he learned that, he learned for the first time what the ultimate foundations of knowledge are. Oh, good for him, you say. Thank God somebody found that out at last. And then you look at the guy, and it becomes ever more interesting. He's the offspring of New England Congregationalism, of that intensely self-scrutinizing, self-discipline form of Protestantism, Unitarian, no belief in the sacraments, no belief in the divinity of Christ. He found something called the Kant Club, which we must both find out about and join. He founds the Journal of
Alec and I, by the way, are very loyal members of the Dull Men's Club.
Dull Men's Club.
It may be, which has been forced by Facebook to rename itself the Dull People's Club. It may be there's some overlap with the club.
I think, I'm sure they thought they were not dull, but they no doubt were dull. Then, interestingly, he becomes the Secretary of Education under one of the presidential administrations. I can't remember which one now. So he goes from being this apparently kind of boffin figure to being a figure exercising real power on the history of higher education in America. I think he's Secretary of Education for 6 or 7 years and is a reforming administrator, whatever. So when I think of someone like John Rawls, and when I think about the extraordinary standing, and I mean by that, I mean the elite standing of these figures and their students, they embody something about American culture that's clearly only a tiny fragment, but it's the inheritor of Puritan self-transformation and transcendence. Yeah, that's the way I'd put it. I'm not sure how we got onto that, but yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you about something in your work that maybe is about transcendence and teleology. Yesterday, I was wearing a T-shirt that said Max Weber, Disenchantment. And when I was first encountering Weber, I was very keen on the idea that we were getting disenchantment from
right.
Magic slash religion.
Yeah.
And some of your work on government, the state, law seems to be about a loosening of religious ties in favor of a secular state, albeit lots of leftovers. Now, the trouble is there's been a re-enchantment of modernity,
yes.
If it was ever gone. It's
yes.
me after my many years living in the United States, but also
absolutely.
In truly Catholic countries like Mexico and here. And if I were to say, if I were to hold you to the stake, as it were, if I were to say to you, is there some kind of motion that you appear to be discerning from the religious state to the secular state, however imperfect? And what would you say to that? And what would you say to the idea that there was a disenchantment and now there's been a re-enchantment?
Well, I think you're onto something. And I think you're onto a residual enthusiasm in some of my work. I've tried to drive all enthusiasm out of it, but of course it's hard to do. You want something that gets you up in the morning. I guess I'd say a few different things. Firstly, I agree overall. Secondly, I would say that the thesis, not that one, you know, one of the worst things about academics is that they always want to be right. And I don't want to say that I was right. But being an academic, I'm inclined to drift in that direction. At the end of Rival Enlightenments, I say that the re-enchantment of politics carried out by Kant, that is in that sense, was successful. And that the secularizing moves made by the people I work on at that point, Samuel Pufendorf, and Christian Timasius and others actually wasn't terribly successful. It's not entirely right, but anyway, if you're doing the history of philosophy, it wasn't successful, and Kantianism was. Yeah, that's true. If you look at the history of the German state and the juridical order, it's a mixed picture. I'm trying to bracket America for the moment because I don't know enough about it. And I think you're absolutely right about what you're implying. But the Germans solved the problem not by secularizing society at all, but only by secularizing the state. And that secularization was done by people who were believers and who continued to be believers, but developed a modus vivendi through the high court system and through the system of constitutional law, in which all religions, well, initially three religions, would have constitutional recognition. They would be banned from proselytizing against each other. They would be allowed to say that only their faith was the absolutely true one, as long as the state said that all of them were true, equally true, and hence equally false, or whatever. And that the population would be taxed to support the religions and to support their schools, and that this system of managed pluralism would become the German religious constitution. And it did, and it was, and it is, actually. So, no, it's a very curious double-sided secularization. And here I've learned an enormous amount, perhaps everything, from a German scholar called Martin Haeckel, who's the premier, who was, I don't know if he's still alive, anyway, has been the premier historian of German church law, of constitutional public law. Tremendous figure. He's a Lutheran and makes no bones about it, but he writes history from a perspective that accepts that religion remains central, but it remains pluralized and governed by something that isn't religious, while he himself is a theologian. So that would be typical, actually. And I'm very comfortable with that. And there's something about my own religious past that is quite comfortable with that. I'm from low church Protestant background. I have no toleration for metaphysics. That's news to you, I'm sure. So when I see that kind of order, I think my response to you at this point would be to say, yes, one can overdo the secularization thing. Yes, I have overdone it. But I've also learned that if you do the history properly, you can see that the churches never went away and they will not go away. But there are forms of governing them that are not themselves religious and metaphysical. That's where we part company with the philosophers, because the philosophers will say, well, of course, the constitutional itself is governed in metaphysics by metaphysics, is grounded in metaphysics. The answer to that is no, you're wrong, and don't say it. That's a sort of tolerant
So this is
answer.
not exactly, it's not exactly separation of church and state, but it means that they have palimpsestical relationships.
They
They
have,
palimpsestical relationships. You know,
yes,
they both they there's a mutual impact. There's relative autonomy. You can see traces of one in the other.
It one of the things that Americans don't understand, and indeed that German philosophers, Kantians, don't understand, is that in Germany, for all the period I'm talking about, say, let's say from the Reformation to now, individuals did not have religious freedom, and they don't, right? The entity that had freedom was the church. The church had to be free in order to teach and to reproduce itself, and it had the right to have that freedom. That is, the freedom not to be molested either by the state or by other churches or by proselytization. And the freedom that individuals have in Germany is derivative of that. In other words, they have the freedom to belong to whichever church they choose or to none. But what they don't have the freedom to do is to change the church in the image of the philosophy or ideology that they adhered to. Now, that was why the Prussians quite rightly tried to censor Kant when he said, I've written a book that shows you that, in fact, religion has a rational basis, and eventually only a rational religion will exist. All of these other religions, Calvinism, Catholicism, Lutheranism, they'll all go by the board. The Jews don't have a religion, said Kant. They don't have a religion at all. They just have a political system of government, a theocracy. So we don't have to put any store by them. That will be erased completely, says Kant. Right? This is this guy, the paragon of freedom, of liberalism, and so forth. You know, and the Prussian state says, "Oh, bugger you! That's not going to wash. We've got a system that accepts toleration of all these people. We even tolerate the Jews," say the Prussians, and they did at this time, right? And you want to sort of abolish all that in the name of what? The truth of your particular philosophy? No, that doesn't happen. So that's a fascinating vignette in this whole history. He evades censorship by sending his book to another state because Germany had so many states at this time, and promises the King of Prussia that he won't teach religion anymore. The King of Prussia dies a couple of years later. Kant's back in the pulpit teaching about religion again, saying, well, I only promised that king, right? I didn't promise the new king. Yeah, okay. We get it. We get
Well,
it.
this reminds me, Ian, of the Areopagitica, which is still held up as the great beacon of free speech, which, of course, Milton did not intend to extend to another sect he didn't like, namely the whole of Catholicism. There's no free speech
Well,
for you bastards, says
exactly.
Calvin.
Well, you know, I mean, in a way, Locke has a similar thing. You know, everyone's free on as long as they use reason. However, there is a church that doesn't use reason, so they're not free. Okay, I get it now. Yeah.
Prof, I have a couple more questions for you,
Yes.
and then I wanted to throw to you, as the actress said to the bishop, for you to add anything you want to what we've discussed. Sound all right
Okay.
as a way of
Yeah.
concluding?
Yeah. Okay.
So, my first question is that I recently read your engagement with the late Barry Hindis on terrorism.
Okay.
Now, can you remember what you said?
It's hovering in the mists at the edge of my memory. But yeah, I think that's an argument that draws on the Westphalian
Yes, exactly. And where
settlement.
more or less Barry was saying, there is a thing called state terrorism that we need to think about
Yes.
just as much as we think about non-state terrorism. And you
Yeah.
were not satisfied with that. If those mists can clear for a moment, can I drag you back into that?
Yes. What's going to happen now is the very thing that I've spent the last 30 years saying shouldn't happen, which is that I'm going to have a retrospective take on what I ha should have said. And that is absolutely verboten, as you know, for an historian. No, I think I remember, I think I remember saying something along these lines to Barry. The reason that state terrorism doesn't play a big role or doesn't get a, you can't use the phrase doesn't get a Guernsey on a podcast like this. People won't know what it means. That doesn't play a role for me is that the states that were set up after Westphalia were religious states, but they were required to tolerate minority religions within them. And sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't, because they didn't follow what the Constitution said, naturally. Were there terrorists? Well, there were terrorists that appeared from out of the religions and from out of the philosophies. There were terrorists in a way, if that's the right word, at the end, at sorry, at the beginning of the, sorry, towards the middle of the 19th century, where German student organizations became very nationalist, and took to had have a, having an early spree of book burning, of claiming that a certain philosophy represented the German people and no other philosophy did. And they killed a guy called Kotzebue, August Kotzebue. He was a liberal supporting, I can't remember what. I'd have to go back and do the reading. This is what can be a problem when one's doing a podcast. But he was assassinated by a radical right-wing member of a student organization, the Burschenschaften, as they called them. And that guy was a true dyed-in-the-wool believer of philosophical idealism, that the German nation was the embodiment of an idealist future, and that somebody like this Kotzebue guy was a threat. And okay, this guy could also have been unhinged. We still have the problem today of, is this terrorism? Is it mental illness? But anyway, he stabbed him to death and sort of got off because the police chief said, oh, well, actually, he was just a bit unhinged. And, you know, after all, this guy was a problem anyway. So that, for me, that would be one way of coming at this, would be to say, yes, you can have state terrorism because we got it soon in the middle of the 20th century in Germany. But you also have an attempted ordering in Germany where the state was meant to be the ringholder for other organizations that were carrying culture and identity and religion and so forth, in which case, in the best of all possible worlds, which we don't live in, you don't have state terrorism. Yeah, that's one answer. I'm not terribly happy with it, I have to say. The other answer is the awful one of who gets to decide that someone's a terrorist, which we're now seeing with regarding the Israeli-Hamas war, for example. And there's a relativistic answer to that, which I don't like, which simply, as is a slogan everyone knows, that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. I'm happier with the view that states, through their governments, can determine what counts as terrorism by having a checklist, and this will include hate speech leading to violence and several other things. And that's a crude way of determining it. And if you were then to say, but what if the state's terrorist? You can't answer that question. It just destroys the entire structure. I'm not sure that Barry was intent on doing that, because one of the wonderful things about Barry is that he never gave up on reason. He was a dyed-in-the-wool rationalist who hoped in the end that reason would prevail and ultimately provide perhaps a solution to some of these intractable problems. Probably already then, I'd become utterly disillusioned with the notion that reason meant anything particularly good or that it could solve any particular problems. So that's probably what was going on with Barry and me at that point, is my guess. Yeah.
And my last
But I owe
question.
him an I owe him an enormous debt, as you know. I'm not we haven't spoken about, you've left it veiled discreetly, my Althusserian period, where I read Barry and read Paul Hurst and wasn't the most sweet and tolerant person you could meet. But let's leave that for another podcast, shall we?
Well, I seem to remember John Docker wrote a piece called "I Was a Teenage Leaver Summit" or something like that,
Yes,
right?
he did. Yes.
And I was a post-adolescent Althusserian, so.
Right.
But he does have in that book, "What Is Philosophy?" Althusser does say philosophy is what people who are in things called departments of philosophy say and do, which was
Yes.
not a very
Yeah.
Althusserian thing to say, but I think.
Yeah.
Right, but he also is saying things like religion is about ritual, it is incarnated materially.
Yes.
In any event,
Yeah.
yes, we shouldn't have mentioned that murderer.
No, just before we leave it, can I put in a plug for Edward Baring's book on Althusser? And it's really a book about the École Normale Supérieure, and about the teaching, not just of Althusserianism, but of Althusserianism and kindred doctrines, particularly Derridean deconstruction, in the École. And it's one of the few, the very few books that treats these people as academics and treats the Ecole as an elite institution. A tremendous book. So, yeah,
I
just
don't know
dropping
it,
that
so
in.
thank you. I still
Okay.
like The Future Lasts a Long Time, Althusser's
Yes.
memoir, where he says
Okay.
things like, I found my hands around, my
Oh
wife's
my God. We're not allowed to talk about that.
and that is
But
just
yes.
awful. And of
Yeah.
course, just as Habermas said, you can see the lineaments of fascism in Heidegger's children, as it were, that one can see an authoritarianism that was awful.
Yeah,
To
yeah.
say that
No, the
Habermas.
Bearing book brings out the fact, for example, that Althusser recruited a small cadre of high achieving students, and they had access to a chateau. This sounds like the Marquis de Sade, actually, where they went and had sort of forced training Althusserian doctrine. One of those people was Alain Badiou. Yeah. Anyway,
So my
enough about the
philosophy is,
Althusserian chateau.
yeah,
Yeah.
my commie camp, commie camp.
Yes, can we...
So my last question, Ian, is about colonialism.
Okay.
You co-edited a really interesting book on British colonialism and law and so on.
Yes.
And one of the things that you talk about in your contributions is, as I understand it, a sort of struggle between public law and natural law, and some of the unfortunate routes taken by anti-colonial critics, be they historians or others,
Yeah.
in trying to construct an edifice of natural law that will delegitimize colonialism. That's what I understand anyway.
Yes, yeah, that's a
Could you
fair
talk to us a
assessment.
bit about that in the context of Europe, not as the cradle of modern civilization, but as the cradle of modern imperialism, world wars, and other forms of suffering.
Yeah. Gosh. They're big questions, aren't they? If you live in a state like Australia, the history of the country is always being written and being contested. These are some of the ter this is some of the terrain on which it is contested. A lot depends on how comprehensively you want to delegitimate the contemporary Australian state and society. Now, if you want to do it very comprehensively, then you've got good tools. Yes, natural law and the conception of a form of justice that was not meted out when it should have been, forms of justice about pertaining to the seizure and occupation of land made under English common law that was meted out and certainly is disadvantageous to the indigenous people. So all of those things are in play. It partly depends on, as I say, at what level you want to access the issue of what Australia is. At that level, you can say those things and it works. Historians that are working at a slightly more micro or lower level have a much more nuanced picture in which the law is not comprehensively opposed to the Indigenous people, in which instructions are sent out from the Colonial Office regarding their protection, regarding the regulation of settlers and their depredations, their illegal takeover of land. Some cases that I looked at the time where soldiers had killed Indigenous people and then actually used natural law arguments to say they were justified in doing so because this was the state of nature, there was no law. To which the magistrate replied, it wasn't the state of nature, it was New South Wales. And New South Wales is a territory under Crown jurisdiction. And under Crown jurisdiction, you are not, they called themselves the Avengers of Nature, the Avengers of the Law of Nature, these guys, or at least their attorney did. To which the magistrate said, no, you're just murderers. So at the micro level, the picture is more nuanced and it's still being worked on. The question that's occupying us elsewhere in the world today of how to crunch the numbers on casualties, deaths, sickness, and so forth is currently being worked on intensively by Australian historians, and the picture is being nuanced as it goes. So that's sort of, I don't have a particularly good answer to the question. I mean, states, if they're not terror states, are things that conquer other states. That's one of the things they do. I mean, you could say a state is a war machine at one level, and its external side, it's a panzer, it's a war machine that deflects other states, conquers them, defends the interior. In the interior, it tries to pacify, produce peaceable citizens, and so forth. But yes, at the edge, states are, yeah, I can't think of a better word. If you look at the Ukraine war, for example, you could say what it means to say a state, a sovereign state, is a war machine. And here is an empire that wants to reestablish itself. Here is another state that defends itself. And if you look at people like Hobbes and Pufendorf, they would say that's what states are and that's what political history is. Yes, they colonize other places, they dispossess people. And if you want to, you can have a moral judgment that that's an awful thing to do. And states continue to do awful things. I feel I haven't answered that terribly well, but that's
No,
the
I
best
think
I
that's
can
a really
do.
interesting response, and it takes us back to Uncle Max, and the state is the place that has a legitimate, in inverted commas, monopoly on violence within its borders.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So to conclude, Prof, I'd like to hand it back to you to add anything you wish, either to what we've already discussed, or if there are things you wish to touch on that we haven't mentioned.
Look, I for me, I should say I've said more than enough. I think I've touched on a lot of the things that partly come out of your and my shared history. Some of the things that have come out of perhaps a later history that I've been through. I'm preoccupied partly by the format of an interview where an academic is interviewed about big questions. It's an enormous temptation to say more than you know, to be better than you are. I don't want to point the finger at David Runciman, or others, but is a temptation amongst academics to think that politics should be grounded in reason and principles, and that they know what reason and principles are, and on that basis, they can make judgments that are binding more or less universally. And this would go to Weber. I mean, Weber said, you know, you should never be a prophet from the a professorial prophet. You should stick to being able to describe what you can provide evidence for. To go back to some of our earlier conversations, not to detect laws of history that will redeem us, but only accidents of history that make us what we happen to have become. What we have happened to become is almost always disappointing. I mean, for us, ourselves, and for the state we live in, and for other awful things that we see going on around us. I think the reason I'm kind of, well, you could say content, others would say complacent about that, is that I think It doesn't hurt to try and find your happiness outside the space of giving moral judgments as an academic. If you can find it in friendship, in family, in music, and so on, then don't underestimate that. You know, that to me is something you can do the academic thing and do it to the best of your ability, but you shouldn't necessarily think that you're going to find the meaning of life and happiness in it. How about that as a final sign off?
That sounds pretty good. I think it takes us back to the Hopeless Battle of the Bands as the real locus of success. So, Professor Ian, thanks so much.
Leave for another podcast. Thanks so much, Toby. Thanks for taking the time and for, doing the memory stuff that brought back to me things we went through, history that we've shared, history that's, as I've been saying relentlessly and boringly, is ongoing and unpredictable, and we don't know where it ends up or where it takes us.